guys, welcome back to the podcast. Today's case is going to be about the infamous Lonely Hearts Killers and how a very devious con man was convinced to let one of his victims become his partner in crime. And I just want to preface this episode by saying that you for sure can feel sorry for the criminals in this case in the beginning. I did too. Neither of their lives were easy, but when you find out all of the heinous stuff that they go on to do to other people, you'll realize that, you know, they deserve to be as miserable as possible, in my opinion. This case is going to have multiple victims and there will be mentions of child abuse. So just want you guys to know that from the get-go. So let's start with the Lonely Hearts ads themselves, since this is how our two killers meet each other and their victims. So the Lonely Hearts ads were originally called personal or matrimonial ads, and they first appeared in newspapers as early as the 1600s, but they really took off in popularity in the 20th century. Because before internet and cell phones, they were the closest things to online dating people had at the time. Some agencies would place ads in the newspapers seeking spouses on behalf of their clients. That's how much of an industry these ads became. But like all things, the Lonely Hearts ads became a way for people to take advantage of other people who were looking for love, who were vulnerable. And it bred a whole new, I guess, category of fraudsters, adventurers, sometimes murderers, because they used these ads to find easy targets. And that's where Martha Beck and Raymond Martinez Fernandez found their victims. So let's start with Martha. Martha Beck was born Martha Seabrook on May 6th, 1919 in Milton, Florida. Her parents were Julia Metz Seabrook and Holland Stanley Seabrook. Martha's childhood was not a happy one. Her mother was very overbearing and her father was very submissive to her mother, but eventually he chose to abandon the family altogether when she was still a child. Now, specifically for Martha, she was born with a glandular problem, which caused her to hit puberty very early on. And I did a little research, and from what I could tell, precocious puberty, as it's known, is basically when children develop sexual characteristics before the age of 8 or 9, where most kids hit their puberty, you know, in their early teens. In girls, it can mean they have an increased height spurt. They can have earlier breast development or even earlier menstruation. And Martha struggled with this kind of early development. And it didn't help that she was also very overweight for her age and that she also started developing sexual desires from about the age of 9. And she started getting teased and bullied a lot in school about this. And then later on in life, she would go on to claim that her brother Dudley molested her. And when she told her mother about this, her mother actually blamed her for it and beat her. So Martha would say that her mother was very domineering and controlling, that any time like a boy would show interest in her, her mother would immediately chase them away. And also her mother would punish her a lot. Like if she caught a boy looking at Martha or, you know, talking to Martha, or a man looking at Martha, because again, she was very developed at an early age, her mother would blame her for this unwanted attention. And so because of this, Martha would run away from home a lot because she was just very unhappy. By the time she got into her teens, she was just sick of all the cruel jokes about her appearance, all the insults, and she started to become more and more withdrawn, and she really didn't have many friends her own age. So Martha eventually finished school and she went on to study nursing in Pensacola, and she graduated in 1942, but she found it very hard to find work. Now, she claimed that this was because of her weight, because she was around 200 or 200 or 300 pounds in weight. And for that time particularly, that was very unusual. But then again, this is her claim, and we don't know if she couldn't find work because of something else and she was blaming it on her weight. I don't know. She tends to victimize herself, as you'll see. But anyway, she ended up finding work as an undertaker's assistant at a local funeral home where she would have to prepare the female bodies for burial. But she didn't stay doing this for very long because she soon left for Florida altogether and she moved to California in the hopes of starting a new life. She got a job working as a nurse at an army hospital, but as she, you know, got into the swing of things, she started spending her nights out going to bars, trying to pick up soldiers and trying to have sex with them. And now because of all of this promiscuous sex she was having, she ended up pregnant. But the father of the child, who was a soldier, he had no interest in being with Martha at all. In fact, when he found out that she was pregnant with his child, he actually attempted suicide by throwing himself into a nearby bay. Now, as you can imagine, this was very upsetting and embarrassing to Martha that this man would actually rather kill himself than marry her. But at the same time, if you are hooking up with all these random soldiers and none of them are in a relationship with you, it's hard to expect someone who doesn't really know you to just decide to commit to marriage with you. But I suppose it was the 40s, so we're talking about a different time period where if someone gets you pregnant, you're supposed to get married. It's that simple. So, regardless, Martha headed back to Florida, pregnant, alone, and feeling pretty depressed about herself. So she came back home, and clearly she had to come up with an excuse for why she was an unmarried pregnant woman. And she actually made up this whole fairy tale about how she was actually married to a Navy officer in California. She went out, she bought herself a wedding ring, she flaunted it around town, telling people that her husband was actually going to be returning from the Pacific very soon and everyone could meet him. But of course, that would never happen because this man doesn't exist. So Martha had to take the lie even further. So she arranged to have a telegram delivered to herself announcing that her so-called husband had been killed in action. And when Martha opened up this telegram, she went into complete hysterics when it was delivered. And the death of Martha's fake husband was actually announced in the local papers, and Martha got a lot of sympathy and attention for her loss from people in her hometown. People felt really sorry for her, that she was this young pregnant widow now. They felt really, you know, people were sympathetic. Her husband was a soldier. He died in action. It was so tragic. And, you know, she got a little bit of sympathy and attention for this. So she went on to give birth to her daughter in 1944. And a few months after this, she met a local bus driver, a man named Alfred Beck. And I'm guessing she kind of tried to do her usual thing where she starts having sex with a guy and then she hopes that this guy will develop feelings for her and marry her. And I'm not sure if this really happened with Alfred, but one thing's for sure, she did get pregnant by him. And, you know, for whatever reason, Alfred did feel a bit guilty or responsible, perhaps. Maybe he bought into her whole fake husband story, how her husband was a dead soldier. And, you know, maybe he felt sympathetic and responsible for her. Anyway, after getting her pregnant, he reluctantly married Martha in 1944, but only 6 months later, they would be getting divorced. So now Martha found herself in even worse circumstances because now she was unemployed, divorced, and the mother of two children with no income. But rather than kind of rise to the challenge and try and get her life together, she just fell further into fantasies and lies, and she became completely caught up in romance novels and movies. In fact, her apartment was filled with all these trashy romance novels and magazines. She was obsessed with these stories, and she dreamed that one day a man would come into her life and just sweep her off her feet. Now, thankfully, by early 1946, she got a job. She was working at a Pensacola hospital for children, and to her credit, Martha was supposedly a really good nurse. She worked very hard and she took her responsibilities at work very seriously. And because she didn't really have any kind of a social life, she poured a lot of her energy into her job. So within her first year at this hospital, she had received a promotion and she went on to become the nurse superintendent of the hospital. But her newfound job success didn't do anything to fill the void in her heart. Martha was still feeling very depressed and she dreamed about having a man all to herself who wanted her for her companionship. She wanted the love and romance that she'd been reading about in these novels and magazines. And it didn't help that even though, you know, she had moved on from the school bullying that she experienced, because at work she was still kind of getting poked fun of. One of her co-workers played a prank on her, actually, and signed her up to join the Lonely Hearts Club. And the ad was posted in the paper. And when Martha read this prank ad, she broke down into tears. Like, she was really embarrassed. But at the same time, she kind of wanted to push against, I guess, this taunting and prove a point. So she decided to fill out a form describing herself to be published in the Lonely Hearts as a way of kind of, I guess, like sticking up her middle finger to the people who are mocking her. But at the same time, in her description of herself, she conveniently left out the fact that she was very overweight and she also had two kids. So Martha's ad was published in the Lonely Hearts, and every day she came home from work and she would check the mailbox in case her Prince Charming wrote her a response. 2 weeks went by without anything at all, and then she finally received her first and only reply around Christmas of 1947 from a man named Raymond Fernandez. So before we get to the letter itself, let's talk about Raymond. Raymond Martinez Fernandez was born on the island of Hawaii in December 17, 1914. His parents were of Spanish descent. They were very proud, hardworking people, but they were a little bit concerned and disappointed with their son Raymond's kind of sickly and frail appearance when he was a child. Raymond's father was particularly unhappy. He wanted Raymond to be bigger and stronger, and he would push him to do a lot of hard work and labor and menial tasks. He was a bit of a bully, I would say. When he was only 3 years old, Raymond and his family moved to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Then in 1923, when Raymond was 19 years old, he decided to go to Spain to work on his uncle's farm, and much to his parents' delight, by this point Raymond had started to grow out of his awkward, feeble, you know, boy phase, and he had now grown into a handsome and well-built young man. He was living and working in the Spanish village of Orgiva, and Raymond was very well liked there. He was calm and he was gentle, and by about the age of 20 he got married to a woman named Encarnacion Robles, and they moved in together and everything was great. Then when the Second World War broke out, Raymond began serving in the Spanish Merchant Marines, and he even went on to serve the British government as a spy collecting intelligence. But because of this, very little is known about his activities in the intelligence community. But according to the security office in Gibraltar, Raymond was, quote, entirely loyal to the Allied cause and carried out his duties, which were sometimes difficult and dangerous, extremely well. Then, after the war ended in late 1945, Raymond decided to go back to America to find work, and then he planned to send word for Encarnacion and their new baby to come and join him. He got passage on a freighter headed to Curacao in the West Indies, and it was on this ship that Raymond's life would be changed forever. So while Raymond was trying to come up on deck, an open steel hatch door cover fell directly on top of his head. Now the impact of this steel door was so harsh that there was actually a severe indentation to Raymond's skull, which caused terrible injuries to his brain. Now, while we don't know what exact damage was done. Either way, his brain was damaged irreversibly, and when the ship docked in December of 1945, Raymond was immediately put into a hospital where he would have to spend the next 4 months until March of 1946. So once Raymond was released from hospital, his personality was completely different. The nice, hard-working, well-mannered, socially capable young man was gone. Now Raymond was distant, moody, and he was very quick-tempered. He didn't smile like before, and he would often start rambling if he was in the middle of a conversation with somebody. Now, all of this change is pretty normal for someone who's had a severe head injury, but because Raymond's particular head injury was around his frontal lobe region, this meant his reasoning and his logic was completely changed. But after he healed up and he was let out of hospital, he bought passage on another ship heading to Alabama. When the boat docked, Raymond did something that was completely stupid and totally unlike his former self. So once again, now we're actively seeing here this new changed version of himself. This was not something that he would have ever done in the past. So he stole a large amount of clothing and items from the ship's storeroom that was clearly marked and accounted for. So when he tried to take all of this stolen stuff through customs, he was immediately caught and arrested. And when he got asked why he would commit such a random and obvious theft, he said, quote, "I don't know. I can't think. I can't say why I did it. I just saw other men putting a towel or two in their bags, so I thought I'd do the same. Only I couldn't seem to stop." So Raymond was sentenced to spend 1 year in the federal penitentiary in Tallahassee in Florida for the theft. And it was in this prison that he met up with a Haitian cellmate. Now, this cellmate was a follower of the Voodoo religion, which is a very ancient religion derived from several African religions. And he introduced Raymond into the world of the occult and the practices of voodoo. Pretty soon after this, Raymond became convinced that voodoo gave him a secret power over women, and that voodoo gave him like these sexual powers, and they enhanced his energy. And he liked reading about, you know, human sacrifice and torture and a lot of the more sensational stuff that perpetuates a lot of myths about voodoo. He enjoyed the more like salacious side of it all. So Raymond actually began telling people that he could actually make love to women from great distances just by using his voodoo powers on them. And while he was in prison, he would write letters to women and he would ask them to send a lock of their hair or an earring or some personal item to him, and he could use it in his voodoo rituals, and then that would strengthen his supernatural control over these women. Then he believed, after doing his ritual, that these women would just fall at his feet, that they would be overwhelmed by his supernatural and erotic powers over them. Then, in 1946, when Raymond was released from prison, he moved to Brooklyn to live with his sister, and his relatives were shocked by his change in appearance. Apparently, you know, now he looked drastically different since his head injury. He was now bald, where before he had had a thick head of dark hair. And then because he was bald, the scar on his head was very visible. But it wasn't just his looks that had changed. His family noticed how different his personality was. He would have these mood swings. His personality was very drastically different to who he was before. And he would also have very painful headaches. And then he would lock himself in his room for whole days at a time. Now, while he was locked in his room, he began writing dozens of letters into the Lonely Hearts ads, where he began trying to seduce gullible, lonely women. And then once he had developed their trust, he would steal their money, steal their jewelry, checks, basically anything of value that he could embezzle from them. And then he would just disappear and ghost these women forever. Now, most of the time, these women were just too embarrassed and mortified to bother reporting him to the police, because it would have been so humiliating if their names got dragged through the mud because they had been in like a Lonely Hearts ad gone wrong situation. And I wonder if maybe it was possible someone in the prison gave him this idea, because again, this was all very new behavior for him. Raymond had never acted like this before the head injury. So I wonder, while he was in prison, did he, like, he was learning about the voodoo, but I wonder, was he also learning about how to become a fraudster, how to become, you know, a scam artist, basically, because he was in there for a whole year, and we know that happens a lot. But anyway, this was his graft. He was deep in with these Lonely Hearts ads. He was writing to multiple women at the same time. And again, he would write to them for a little while, then he would meet up with them for a little while. And once he had gotten their trust, he would start scamming them for money. And it was working for him. He'd basically found a way to make money without really having to work very hard for it. So Raymond began corresponding with a woman named Jane Lucilla Thompson in 1947. Jane had recently separated from her husband and she was working in New York as a cook. She was lonely and she was very, very easy for Raymond to charm. It didn't take long for Jane to agree to meet Raymond in person. And in October 1947, they bought a cruise ship ticket together, using Jane's money, of course. And they went on a trip to Spain together. They traveled together for several weeks. And in fact, they actually started booking hotels as man and wife. Apparently they had a great time, they were dining out, they were seeing all the sights across the Spanish countryside together, and I'm sure Jane was just thrilled that this Spanish man had taken her to Spain and was introducing her to kind of this good life, I suppose. But remember, Raymond is still legally married to his actual wife, Encarnacion, and guess what he does? He takes Jane to meet Encarnacion and his children, because he had had a couple of children with Encarnacion. And the three of them, Raymond, Jane and Encarnacion, actually went out for dinner together. So I don't know exactly what Raymond was telling the two women about each other, or what version of the truth he was kind of spinning. But eventually the happy trio kind of soured with each other. And on the night of the 7th of November, 1947, something bad must have happened between Jane and Encarnacion. They had a disagreement that eventually turned into a full-blown fight between Raymond and Jane at their hotel in La Linea. And Jane threatened, you know, she was pissed off and she threatened to return to the United States on her own. Because remember, she was the one who paid for the tickets. And in the end, Raymond was seen running out of their hotel room late that night. The next morning, the body of Jane Lucilla Thompson was found in her hotel room, and the exact cause of her death wasn't determined at the time, but it was suspected that she had died of a heart attack triggered by gastroenteritis. However, it was believed that she had been drugged by Raymond, and then she died as a result of this. But to make things even worse, her body was buried without an autopsy, which gave Raymond time to skip town, leaving Encarnacion and his children behind again. So he caught the next boat going back to the US, and he headed to Jane's old apartment in New York City, because he had forged a last will and testament belonging to Jane, saying that she had left everything to him and that he was now the owner of her apartment, and all her furnishings and belongings, even though her elderly mother still lived there, and he kicked this poor old woman out. So now Raymond has conned multiple women, abandoned his wife and kids again, probably murdered Jane Thompson and confiscated her apartment. So we can definitely say that the old Raymond is gone. And throughout this entire time, he was still corresponding with multiple women through the Lonely Hearts ads, one of them being Martha Seabrook Beck. So now we're going to go back to Pensacola. Martha has just come home from work at the hospital, and she finally got a letter from a man. This man named Raymond Fernandez, who lived at West 139th Street in New York City, which was Jane's apartment. In his letter to Martha, he told her that he was a successful and well-respected businessman who had made a fortune in import and export trades. His letter was written very elaborately. He was very courteous and he sounded sincere. Raymond told Martha that he was Spanish, and he had recently come to America for better business opportunities. Sorry. He also told Martha that he lived alone, quote, in this apartment, much too large for a bachelor, but I hope someday to share it with a wife. He also flattered Martha, saying that he chose to write to her specifically because she was a nurse, and he said, quote, I know you have a full heart with a great capacity for comfort and love. Now, this letter from this wonderful, mannerly, successful Spaniard was too much for Martha. She was hooked. She was swept off her feet. She was starry-eyed. One letter, that's it. Seal the deal. She couldn't believe how well-spoken he was, how expressive he was. She knew that she had to, you know, reel this man in. So she went out and she bought herself some expensive stationery and she started writing dozens of letters to Raymond over a 2-week correspondence. She also included some photos of herself, but she didn't want to scare Raymond away because of her obesity. So she only sent him photos with her and other nurses where her body was partially covered. She really wanted to impress him so badly. But what she didn't know was Raymond didn't actually care what she looked like. Size, appearance, age. It was of no concern to Raymond because he only cared about defrauding, tricking and stealing women. He didn't care if they were fat, skinny, old, young. The only thing that he wanted to know was if they had any money or assets that he could take. So because Martha was a nurse, he presumed that she probably had some money saved up, or maybe she had a house of some value. So he decided to develop a little bit of a relationship with her, starting with mailing letters back and forth, maybe a telephone call too, and then he would arrange a face-to-face meetup. Now, this is what he liked to do. He liked to build up the trust as well as some kind of sexual anticipation with his victims. And he had written so many letters to so many different women that he had actually developed a standard routine, almost like a script, that he followed with every single woman right up to the end. He would also use a false name, and most of the time he called himself Charles Martin, which helped him avoid detection. So he had a script written out. He would basically just change the women's names and basic minor details here and there, and that was it. He would just post out all these letters. He had the system down. But he was so full of himself that he actually thought he could steal money from these women kind of as payment for the few weeks of happiness that he gave them by writing to them and giving them his attention. He thought that, you know, he was such a wonderful lover that he was doing these women a favor and, you know, taking their money. Well, they kind of owed it to him, basically. But anyway, he followed his usual script with Martha. And after a few weeks of writing to her, he asked her for a lock of her hair. Now, Raymond used this hair to perform his usual voodoo rituals, which he believed would make Martha unable to resist his overpowering sexual charms and just make her that much easier for him to take advantage of her. Martha had no clue about this voodoo ritual. Instead, she thought this was just so romantic that this man writing to her now wanted a lock of her hair. Like, it sounded like something straight out of one of her romance books. So she happily sent him a generous chunk of her hair and she doused it in her perfume, thinking that, you know, this was just, the height of romance. So after Raymond had built up Martha's anticipation and he did his voodoo ritual with her hair, he decided that it was finally time to meet up in person. So he took a train down from New York to Florida, where Martha would meet him at the station. But this posed a bit of a problem for Martha, because writing to Raymond was all well and good, but now meeting up with him in person was very scary, because Raymond would see her in person and she would have to show herself fully to him, and she was not going to be able to hide her weight or her appearance anymore. So even though she was extremely nervous, her desire and curiosity about Raymond was just too strong. And she went to the train station, and they finally met each other in person on December 28th, 1947, when Raymond arrived in Pensacola. Now, inwardly, Raymond was surprised at Martha's size, but he gave her no outward signs of disapproval. Martha, on the other hand, was thrilled. She could not believe this handsome man was so interested in her that he would travel all the way from New York just to see her. Raymond was everything she had dreamed of and more. He also was wearing a toupee, which hid his baldness and his massive head scar. But she thought he looked great. She was very charmed by him. And she happily took him back to her home and introduced her to her two children and prepared dinner. After the meal and the children were put to bed, Raymond made his move. Now, Martha was very excited to have sex with him. And for the first time, she kind of had sexual fulfillment instead of it just being about the man's pleasure. And again, this was just the icing on the cake. This was everything she wanted. But Raymond was still just scheming. He was waiting to learn about Martha's assets, how much she was worth, and basically weighing up if she was worth his time and effort. So he spent the next day and night with Martha, and they had sex together multiple times. And this was all it took for Martha to swear her undying love to Raymond. And she told him that she wanted him to stay in Florida and she wanted him to marry her. But Raymond did not want to be married. Not to her, not to anybody. And when he realized that Martha was poorer than he expected, he decided that she was no longer worth his time grafting. So he made up an excuse. He said that he wanted to continue working and doing his business in New York. Actually, he really urgently needed to get back to New York. And he was trying to break it to Martha gently. So he said he would come back to visit her in Florida as soon as possible, but he couldn't stay. He had to get back to the city, da da da. And Martha was not happy. She did not want him to leave so soon. And so Raymond had to kind of shift gear. And he said, actually, he would go back to New York and then he would send Martha money for her to join him in New York. Now, this made Martha happy. She thought that this was almost like a kind of proposal in a way, that, you know, Raymond wasn't ready for marriage with her yet, but that he did want to take their relationship further and that he wanted her to be in New York with him. So Raymond goes back to New York, but immediately Martha just gets carried away in the fantasy. And as soon as Raymond is on the train, she goes around telling everyone locally she's about to be married again and she's in love. And like, she convinced so many people that her and Raymond were going to be married that a bridal shower was prepared for her. And she was happier than she had ever been because she thought Raymond was the man of her dreams. But on the day of the wedding shower, she got a letter from Raymond telling her that she had misunderstood his feelings for her and that he wouldn't be returning to Florida to be with her. Now, Martha obviously was devastated. She was crushed and heartbroken by this letter. And she, I don't know if she really attempted suicide, but she wrote to Raymond and told him that she was suicidal. And eventually he relented and he agreed to let Martha visit him in New York. So again, he was trying to keep her at a hand's distance. But Martha was undeterred. She was going to get this man one way or another. So she got herself some leave time from work and she went up to New York and she spent 2 wonderful weeks with Raymond. But she had to go back to Florida. She had her kids still. But she was fired from her job basically as soon as she got back without really any explanation or notice. Now, according to Martha, she believed that she got fired because her employer might have found out about her kind of scandalous affair with this man in New York. I don't know, again, if that was the reason. Maybe it was. But she had to go pick up her last paycheck. And she decided, basically, now that she didn't have a job in Florida anymore, there was nothing really keeping her there, so she went straight home. She got her and her two kids' belongings all packed up. She went around, said goodbye to her acquaintances, and she got them on the first bus to New York City. Now, this next part is actually kind of great. Just imagine this. On the morning of January 18th, 1987, there was a knock on Raymond Fernandez's door, and he opened the door and found Martha and her two kids standing there. And for the first time in his life, one of his victims had turned the tables on him. So now his plans were completely thrown out of whack. Like, he thought that he was getting rid of her little by little, like telling her he wouldn't marry her, telling her that she had misunderstood his feelings, telling her that, you know, he wasn't going to be bringing her to New York permanently to be with him, and he was not going to be going to Florida to be with her. But Martha was so stubborn that she completely ignored all his attempts to get rid of her. So he actually, it's kind of funny, he was at his last resort, and he actually admitted to her that he was a con man and that he had been conning her in the hopes that maybe this would finally make Martha go away. But this, even this information didn't have its desired effect. She still wanted to be with him, even after finding out that he had been playing her. So Raymond was like, what the hell am I gonna do now? He had to weigh up the situation in his head. And then he thought, maybe it mightn't actually be so bad having Martha around. After all, she's obsessed with him. She comforts him. She caters to every one of his needs, literally. So he decided, okay, I will let you stay on one condition. Your kids have to go. And Martha was initially reluctant, but she thought to herself, if giving up her kids was the price of getting to have Raymond and be with him, then that price was worth it. So on January 25th, 1948, Martha took her two small kids to a random Salvation Army in New York City, and she abandoned them there, and she had no contact with either of them and never even thought about them for another 3 years. So yeah, this, at this time right here, this is where all sympathy for Martha can go out the door. She might have had a hard time growing up. I don't care. That's where I was like, no, you're just a really, really bad person. So anyway, now Martha and Raymond, they're free of the kids. They had the apartment in New York all to themselves. And Raymond decided to bring out all of his Lonely Heart Ads letters. And he decided to tell Martha everything. His whole scheme about all the dozens and dozens and dozens of women that he had scammed and robbed. He even told her about his wife back in Spain. That's how much, like, he knew Martha was devoted to him. He knew he could basically tell her anything and she wasn't going to leave. Because baby, if she hadn't left by now, you know, he was like, he knew she was a sucker for him. So Martha heard all of this and she was so fully committed to Raymond that, you know, she had no interest in turning back. And now she felt it was actually her duty as his woman to help him in his schemes. So together, they made plans to get his next victim. They decided that they would pick the victims together. Then Raymond would write to the victim and lure her in. Then Martha would pose as his sister or sister-in-law and almost act as a kind of chaperone to make the victim feel more comfortable getting to know this man, because there was another woman around. So Martha's one stipulation, though, in this whole situation was that Raymond wouldn't be having sex with any of these women, that he would still continue to be with her. So they went through all the photos of the women in the Lonely Hearts ads and they settled on a woman named Esther Henney from southern Pennsylvania. So the two of them traveled to Pennsylvania to meet Esther, with Martha posing as Raymond's sister-in-law. And I shit you not, within 1 week, on February the 28th, 1948, Esther and Raymond were married in a very brief ceremony at the county clerk's office in Fairfax, Virginia. Then The three of them, Raymond, Esther, and Martha, travel back to Raymond's New York apartment. Esther said that after about 4 days, Raymond, who had been very nice to her, suddenly became very verbally abusive when she wouldn't sign over her insurance policies and her teacher's pensions fund to him. Things then began to go more and more downhill quickly from there, because then Esther started to hear the rumours about him going to Spain with a woman who died mysteriously and never came back. Shortly after this, Esther made the very wise decision to leave the apartment in New York without her car and without the hundreds and hundreds of dollars that Raymond had stolen from her, but at least she escaped with her life. After Esther, multiple other women were the victims of the scheme. One of them was a woman named Myrtle Young, who was from Green Forest in Arkansas. She also agreed to meet Fernandez. And on August 14th, 1948, Raymond married Myrtle in Cook County, Illinois. Now, Martha was there again, and she was posing as his sister. This time she made sure to do everything in her power that Raymond would not consummate the marriage with Myrtle. She even went as far as to insist that she and Myrtle should share a bed, not Myrtle and Raymond. That was her one rule, but as we know, Raymond wasn't really interested in being monogamous. So this weird arrangement went on for the first few days after the wedding, where Myrtle and Martha were sharing a bed. But eventually Martha finally had enough and just lost her cool. She wanted to sleep with her husband. She wanted that intimacy with him. So Raymond gave Myrtle a heavy dose of drugs, which caused her to fall unconscious. Now, we don't exactly know if Myrtle took these pills willingly or if she was forced to ingest them. Again, it kind of goes back to the same thing that he did with Jane Lucilla Thompson. He pumped her full of drugs. But anyway, this gave Martha and Raymond the opportunity to rob Myrtle of $4,000. After that, Raymond and Martha carried Myrtle, who was very unconscious, onto a bus and they sent her back to Little Rock, Arkansas, where she had to be carried off the bus by a police officer who brought her to Little Rock Hospital, where she died from a brain hemorrhage the next day. Now, after this, Martha and Raymond continued traveling east. They stopped along the way to meet a variety of women that Raymond had been corresponding with, stealing some of their money, but none of them really stood out as being worth a long-time investment of time and energy. So they decided to go back to New York, and they kept hunting the Lonely Hearts ads for more victims. They found a woman in New England, but when they met her, she was actually a bit younger and probably more attractive than Martha imagined. And so once again, Martha's jealousy got the better of her, and she actually refused to let Raymond continue the scam on this woman. But this meant that their funds were dwindling lower and lower, and neither of them had a real job. So Martha and Raymond were getting a bit desperate. So they quickly located a woman named Janet Fay, who was a 66-year-old widow living in Albany, New York. And Raymond began writing to her immediately. Now, Janet was fairly well off. She was renting a spacious apartment in downtown New York, and she had a fair bit of money in the bank. She was also a very religious Catholic woman who went to Mass every Sunday, and Raymond exploited this about her. He told her that he shared her religious beliefs, and Janet had been in the habit of writing to the Lonely Hearts ads, even though her friends and family warned her not to. They thought it was dangerous. But as soon as Raymond began scamming and he began writing to Janet about God and religion, Janet was just drawn in. And after writing to each other for several weeks, she was convinced that Raymond's motives were honorable. So she agreed for him to come to Albany to meet her just before New Year's Day. So on December 30th, 1948, Martha and Raymond arrived in downtown Albany, and they checked into a hotel together under the name Mr. and Mrs. Fernandez. The next day, Raymond showed up at Janet's door carrying a bouquet of flowers for her. They spent the day together, they got closer, and they were bonding together, talking about religion. Then, over a couple of days, Raymond began bringing Martha with him, and he introduced Martha to Janet as his sister, and Martha was chaperoning their dates, making the very pious Janet feel more comfortable. They had dinner together and they toured around New York City, and Janet allowed them to sleep over in her apartment. And again, just like all the other women, soon enough Raymond proposed to Janet and she quickly accepted. They made plans to move to Long Island together, where Martha had already rented an apartment at 15 Adeline Street. So in January 1949, Janet began taking out all of her money out of her bank accounts in Albany, which amounted to about $6,000 in cash and checks. And after that, Fernandez convinced her to leave Albany for good. So on January 4th, 1949, Raymond, Martha, and Janet left Albany and they drove to Long Island to move into their new apartment. They got to the apartment and they ate some dinner together and then they settled in for the night. Raymond fell asleep first, which left Janet and Martha alone together. Now, Janet began asking Martha some questions about Raymond's childhood, which, as his supposed sister, she should be able to answer them no problem. But Martha refused to answer, and clearly things got heated and turned into an argument, and Janet became so angry that she told Martha that she would not allow her to continue to live with her and her new husband. Now, Martha said, Janet shouted, quote, "I won't allow you to live with us. You're the most brazen bitch I've ever seen." And what happened after this isn't fully known because, again, Martha lies. She victimizes herself and she also tells authorities a variety of stories. But she claimed that after Janet said this, Janet started marching down the hall to tell Raymond how unhappy she was with his sister living with them, which made Martha just see red. You know, she, in her own words, she was absolutely burning up with jealousy and anger. The fact that this woman would try and come between her and Raymond, and that Janet thought she could go to Raymond and basically tell him to kick her out. Martha was furious and she grabbed a ball peen hammer and she struck Janet in the head with it. Now, this happens and Raymond's basically telling Martha, like, just keep her quiet. I don't care what you do. Just shut her up and keep her quiet. Martha said afterwards, after hitting Janet with the hammer, that she blacked out and that she couldn't remember what happened next. She testified, quote, "The next thing I knew, Fernandez had me by the shoulders and he was shaking me." She said that she saw Janet's body lying on the ground at her feet, bleeding profusely from a very severe head wound. Janet had been bludgeoned to the point of unconsciousness with the ball peen hammer, but she wasn't dead. So they took a scarf and they wrapped it around Janet's neck and they used it as a tourniquet to strangle her. Now, after killing Janet, Martha says that she went into some kind of a trance, that she and Raymond, they just cleaned up the room, that they wrapped up Janet's body in some towels and sheets, and then they pushed her body into a closet. And after that, they just went to sleep. The next day, Raymond and Martha, they bought a large trunk and they dumped Janet's body inside it. Then they drove over to Raymond's sister's house and they convinced her to let them store the trunk in her basement for a while. After 11 days, Raymond went to his sister's house and he retrieved the trunk with Janet in it. Then he brought the trunk down into the cellar basement area of a rented house, and I didn't know if this was the rented house that they had been renting in Albany or the one they had been renting in Long Island. But anyway, he dug a hole in the basement, he put Janet into it, and then he covered it with cement. Then, after getting rid of the body, For the next week, he and Martha went around to the local banks cashing all of Janet's checks, and they also started writing and typing out letters to send to her family and friends, pretending to be Janet, saying that she was having the time of her life, that she had never been so happy in her whole life before. But the problem is, they made a massive mistake by doing this, because they didn't know that Janet didn't own a typewriter and that she couldn't even type at all. So when her family got these typed letters, they were immediately suspicious and they notified the police. But anyway, after they had killed and buried Janet and taken all of her money, Martha and Raymond, again, they just picked up and headed off. They actually had a new victim lined up. So they headed straight for Grand Rapids, Michigan, where they knew their victim was just waiting for them. Because for the past few weeks, Raymond had been writing to another woman. This was a widow named Delphine Downing. Delphine was originally from Nebraska. She was 31 years old and she had a 2-year-old daughter named Raynell Downing. Her husband, named Roland, had died only a year before. He was actually a victim of a truck train accident. So Delphine, she was lonely, she was desperate for a husband. You know, it was hard on her, and she was an easy target. Now, Delphine knew Raymond by his false name, Charles Martin. So, just like all the others, Raymond told her that he was a successful businessman in the export trade business, and he actually told her that he loved children. So when Charles offered to come to Grand Rapids with his sister Martha, Delphine was pleasantly surprised and agreed to meet him. Delphine and Charles, who was Raymond, met in late January 1949, and Delphine was very impressed with him, and she thought maybe she could have a future with this guy. She liked his courteous manners and how considerate he was towards her baby, Raynell. Now, within the month, Raymond or Charles, whichever name he was going by, he was having regular sex with Delphine, which had Martha seething with jealousy and rage. Because if you look at any pictures of Delphine, she's very pretty, she's very cute. And I'm sure it made Martha sick that Raymond was showering this woman with attention, with affection, and that he was also being kind to her daughter, who, like, was a slap in Martha's face. Raymond had made Martha get rid of her 2 children to be with him, whereas now he was being kind and considerate and caring towards Raynell. So Martha was flipping out. And it was only a matter of time before Delphine's happiness ran out, because it was a weird kind of a little moment. But she walked in one morning on Charles, or Raymond, using the bathroom, and she saw him for the first time without his toupee. She saw that he was entirely bald, and she saw that he had this massive scar on his head. And she started to feel a little bit betrayed and worried that Charles was trying to deceive her. Now, Charles, Raymond, he tried to turn on his usual charm and calm her down, but this wasn't working, and the more he buttered her up, the more Martha was burning with rage and jealousy. So Martha, as she says she did, again, take this with a grain of salt, maybe it was willing, maybe it wasn't. Martha says that she convinced Delphine to take some sleeping tablets to help her calm down. But as the pills took effect, baby Raynell started crying. So this caused Martha to completely lose it. She lost her temper and she grabbed the little child and began choking her into unconsciousness. But this brutal attack left very obvious bruises on the little child's neck, and Raymond was not happy about what Martha had done. She was being too impulsive. He was annoyed at her about this, and he was angry that she never thought anything through. Like, just like she had done with Janet, you know, like, just coming up behind her and hitting her with a hammer. Like, he was getting more and more frustrated with how reckless she was. But he was also thinking a few steps ahead, and he realized that as soon as Delphine woke up from these sleeping pills and saw that Raynelle had been abused and choked, that she would immediately go to the police about this. So Martha begged Raymond to do something. He went into the next room. He got a handgun that had belonged to Delphine's husband, Roland, before he died. He wrapped the gun in a blanket and he put the gun to Delphine's head, pulling the trigger and killing her instantly. And the most horrific part was that little Raynelle saw the whole thing from just a few feet away. So Martha and Raymond wrapped Delphine up in some sheets and they carried her down into the basement, where again they dug a large hole and then they dumped her body inside it. Then Raymond covered the hole with cement while Martha was upstairs cleaning up the murder scene in the house. Now, for the next 2 days, as usual, they made their plan to escape again. They cashed in whatever checks Delphine had and they took anything of value in her house. But meanwhile, poor little Raynelle, she constantly cried without her mother. She was scared of Martha and she was scared of Raymond. She had seen that they hurt her mom, and even though she was very small, she did not trust either of these two adults, and she was refusing to eat, which only made her crying even worse. And so the couple couldn't decide what to do with her. We know that they have no interest in children and they have no mercy towards children, but they also knew that they couldn't drop off Raynelle at an orphanage because it would draw too much suspicions. And eventually Raymond told Martha, just like with her other two children, to get rid of this child too. Now, Martha suddenly changed her tune, pleading with Raymond that she couldn't do it, that she couldn't get rid of this baby. She couldn't kill the baby, even though she had no problem strangling her with her bare hands. But I think Raymond was blaming Martha for causing this whole mess to begin with, and he wasn't going to do, I guess, all of it for her. And I think he kind of had her over a barrel here, so she knew she was in too deep. She had already been involved or the cause of a couple of murders, and she had been a part of dozens of fraud schemes and thefts by now. She had no home to go back to. She had abandoned her own two children for him. And even if she didn't necessarily want to kill Raynelle, she knew she had to do what Raymond told her to do. And so, in her most horrific act yet, Martha went down to the basement and she took some of the dirty water that had accumulated down in the basement and she filled a metal tub with it. Then she picked up little Raynelle and she held her under the water in the basin until she drowned. Then Raymond dug a second, smaller grave next to Delphine and he put her dead daughter into it. So, after murdering a victim, we know Raymond and Martha usually hightail it out of there. But for whatever reason, this time they didn't. Instead, they chose to go into town and go see a movie together. They sat down at the cinema, they had some popcorn. But when they came back to Delphine's house to begin packing up their bags, there was suddenly a knock on the door. And that's when Raymond opened the door to find two very unhappy looking police officers standing outside. Because at some stage between all the screaming and noise and then the very sudden silence and disappearance of Delphine and Raynelle, two of their concerned neighbours had decided to call the police. So when they were arrested and questioned on the 28th of February in 1949, Martha and Raymond were brought to the Kent County DA's office. And for whatever reason, maybe they were just resigned to their fate, neither of them bothered asking for an attorney, and neither of them even tried to avoid the questions they were being asked. And they pretty much admitted everything they had done to the police straight out. So after giving full confessions, the police began exhuming the bodies in the basement. Now, when Delphine and Raynelle were buried together, they were both wearing blue dresses and the little child was clasped in the left arm of her mother, and the two of them looked as if they were peacefully sleeping in their shared casket. Reverend Mr. Denchfield said, "Not even the dumbest animals stoop to such bestiality as has been shown here. It is beyond the compassion of any person with a natural Christian love to believe a fellow human being capable of such vicious treatment of anyone, especially an innocent child." After the service, Raynell and Delphine's bodies were brought back to Palisades, Nebraska, where they were laid to rest on the 4th of March in 1949. Now, meanwhile, Raymond and Martha, they were still busy confessing. Raymond had said to the police, quote, "I'm no average killer." And then he went on to brag about his, you know, his long winding story of sex and deception and murder. And in the end, Martha and Raymond signed a 73-page confession in front of the DA with the promise that they wouldn't be handed over to the New York police because they knew that there was no death penalty in Michigan. And they were worried about being sent back to New York and being charged with the murder of Janet Fay. Now, after this, the Lonely Hearts murder case was all over national headlines. And America was completely caught up in the scandal of this very dysfunctional murderous couple and all of the bodies that they had buried along the way. Now, a lot of the press was focused on Martha. They loved to cover Martha. They called her fat, simpering, unattractive, and each article made a strong point of describing her weight. But not that I feel sorry for her. I hope she was humiliated. It's the least she deserves. But it only fueled people's hate for the couple and hate for her especially. And the more people read about how disgusting and deplorable Raymond and Martha were, the more they were pressuring for them to receive the death penalty. People really wanted them both to die for what they had done. Eventually, this led to several calls from New York Governor Thomas Dewey to the officials in the state of Michigan, and they decided to come to an agreement with the Kent County prosecutors. The decision was made to waive the criminal charges for the murders of Delphine and Raynell Dowling, which would permit the couple to then be extradited to New York, where they could be charged with the murder of Janet Fay. This meant if they were found guilty in New York, they could be given the death penalty. Now, this whole trial was a bit of a circus. The summer of 1949 was particularly hot, and the entire country was gripped by the trial of Martha Beck and Raymond Fernandez, which began on the 28th of June. A young Manhattan attorney named Herbert E. Rosenberg was chosen to represent and defend both Martha and Raymond. Now, even though this is unfair to the accused and a violation of ethics, the decision to have only one person represent both of the accused was upheld, which just shows from the get-go that this trial wasn't really being taken seriously. No one cared about the defendant's rights or the possibility of an unfair trial because, as far as everyone was concerned, they deserved to die anyway. And the trial was really just for show, because in most people's minds, the verdict had already been decided. Now, Judge Ferdinand Pecora had the reputation of being very fair but stern, and he liked to keep things moving along in his trials. The prosecution team was headed by Nassau County DA Edward Robinson Jr., and he had been on this case from day one. And he had actually played a part in the deal that got Raymond and Martha extradited from Michigan. The prosecution case began with a bunch of different witnesses, including the medical examiner, friends of Janet Fay, as well as the landlord of her apartment. Then the Michigan investigators took the stand, as well as some forensic investigators, and the court was shown evidence of the blood-stained trunk where Janet Fay's body had been found. Raymond Fernandez took the stand on July 11th, 1949, and he denied any role in killing Janet Fay. Instead, he claimed that he only confessed to killing her to the Michigan authorities to save Martha. He said, quote, "All my statements were made up for the purpose of helping Martha. I love her. It couldn't be anything else." It was basically his assertion that as a man, he could take the prison time, and he didn't want Martha to have to go through that. So, as we can see, the two of them were still kind of thick as thieves with each other at this point, which isn't always the case. When a couple who murder together gets brought to trial, usually they kind of split up to defend themselves. But anyway, Raymond wanted to retract his entire statement. And while they were in court, Raymond would often smile at Martha, and then she would kind of return these little smiles. And when he was talking, she would nod and encourage him as he spoke through his testimony. And on the stand, Raymond, he did a pretty good job of appearing again like a very charming, sophisticated Spanish gentleman. But the prosecutor wasn't going to let this whole charade go on. He tore up Raymond's story, and he brought up also the other victims. He brought up Jane Thompson, Delphine, and Raynell Dowling, Myrtle Young, all these other people who were dead because they had met Raymond Fernandez. And when the prosecutor started raising his voice at Raymond, Martha actually rose up from her seat and exclaimed, "Mr. Fernandez is not death." But despite him saying that he wanted to retract his statement, the statement itself came back to bite the defendants on the ass. It was 73 pages long, and page after page of the confessions were read in the trial. It detailed all of their schemes, all of their deceptions, the sex, the frauds, the murders, all of it. And in Raymond's testimony in particular, he described the sexual relationships he had with his various victims. And at one point, he described a three-way strip poker game that he played with Martha and Esther Henney. And if you remember, Esther was one of the earlier victims who had met Martha and Raymond while Martha was still claiming to be his sister. And she had lived with Martha and Raymond for a while until they robbed her of her car and her money, but she managed to escape with her life. Well, anyway, Raymond described this game of strip poker that he had with Martha and Esther. And the prize for winning this game was that one of the women would have the pleasure of sleeping with Raymond. And Martha won this game. So maybe this was where Esther started to realize, like, all is not well between these two. And maybe they're not brother and sister. So the confessions were very salacious. And people in the courtroom were gasping sometimes. They were shocked. They were horrified. And that also included Martha's confessions in her statement. She said to the Michigan officials at one stage, "I can still hear it. The blood was dripping, dripping, dripping. And the sound of it just sounded like it could be heard all the way over the house." Now, Martha also described in her confession, while Raymond was strangling Janet, that her false teeth had actually fallen out. And after that, that they had decided to dispose of Janet's false teeth, in her words, because, quote, "We realized in case her body was found, if the teeth were there, that they would be a mode of identification." Again, this was just showing the court how carefully and deviously these two people thought about things. So when the prosecutor asked Raymond flat out if he had shot and killed Delphine Dowling, Raymond said, "That is true." But he still continued to deny killing Janet Fay. Then it came for Martha to testify. The anticipation had been building in court and in the public for weeks, wondering if she would finally turn on Raymond or if she would try and take responsibility for the murders to save him. When it eventually came time for Martha to testify, the courtroom was packed to absolute capacity. So Martha's name was called on the morning of July 25th, 1949. She got up from the defense table and she walked to the witness stand, and she was wearing a gray and white polka dot summer dress with a necklace with two strands of pearls, and she was also wearing a pair of green wedge shoes. And apparently this outfit was considered very inappropriate for the courtroom. Martha began her testimony by talking about her childhood and all the problems that she faced as a child. She even claimed that the incestuous attacks from her brother had left her pregnant when she was 13, and that she went on to say that she had been dreaming of being in love, but that her luck with men was terrible and that she had attempted suicide on several occasions because she was so miserable, that every time she would develop a romantic relationship, it would just go nowhere. And she said every marriage and boyfriend and relationship she had was a disaster. And even after having two children with two different men, she still couldn't keep a committed relationship. She then went on to talk about her relationship with Raymond. She said that she knew he was a murderer and that she had helped him find lonely, vulnerable women to victimize. She said, quote, Raymond got quite a kick out of the photographs some of the old hags would write to him and expect him to correspond with them. And at times, Martha would even start giggling when she recalled how easily Raymond could trick his victims. So she wasn't really doing herself any favors when she would talk like this, because it was just showing everybody how heartless she was. Then when the prosecutors asked about her love for Raymond, she still continued to defend him. And she said, quote, we loved each other and I consider it absolutely sacred. You referred to the lovemaking as abnormal. But for the love I had for Fernandez, nothing is abnormal. She also said, quote, a request from Mr. Fernandez to me is a command. I loved him enough to do anything he asked me to do. She also said that she didn't remember killing Janet Fay. She said the only thing that she could remember was finding Janet dead at her feet, bleeding profusely all over the rug. And then she described using a scarf as a tourniquet to choke Janet. And she described all of this with a very straight face, saying that her, quote, training as a nurse taught her that a tourniquet about the neck would stop bleeding from the head. Now, then after 3 days, Martha was questioned relentlessly by the DA. And sometimes throughout this, Martha would become tearful or angry or kind of rebellious. And then when she would give some more kind of graphic details of her sexual relationship with Raymond, including certain sex acts connecting to voodoo, there had to be 24 cops come in to deal with the crowds of people trying to push their way into the courtroom, because it almost became a riot. But finally, on August 18th, 1949, after 44 days of testimony, the case was left in the hands of the jury. And after beginning their deliberations, they had to ask for another reading of Raymond Fernandez's confession. The jury worked through the night to come to a conclusion. And finally, they found Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck guilty of first-degree murder. The two defendants honestly didn't seem too surprised. And then on August 22nd, Martha and Raymond stood very impassively as Judge Pecora sentenced them both to die in the electric chair on October 10th of that year. After that, they were both on their way to Sing Sing prison, where they would wait on death row. But if you thought their stay at Sing Sing would be uneventful, you'd be wrong. Their stay was probably one of the most tumultuous in the prison's history. And they arrived on August 19th, 1949, and this began a whole soap opera between the two of them. In September of 1950, it was rumored that Martha was having an ongoing sexual relationship with one of the guards, and that actually made front cover news. Martha claimed it was Raymond who was starting the rumors about her, but Raymond apparently believed the rumors and he submitted court papers to have his death sentence sped up. The petition stated, quote, the triangle subjects him to mental torture beyond endurance and requests that all appeals on his behalf be stopped immediately so that he can be executed forthwith. Now, Martha was embarrassed that the public and her family would hear these rumors about her having an affair with a prison guard and believe them. She wanted her attorney to put a stop to it immediately. She said, quote, what do they expect me to do? Sit here and let him destroy the one thread of decency I have left? He has done so much talking about how he has me wrapped around his finger that it was a blow to his ego when I unwrapped myself and forgot all about him. All I can say is, what a character. So Martha and Raymond's love-hate relationship continued while they were both behind bars. Sometimes they professed their undying love to each other through letters, and then other times they belittled each other and hardly spoke at all. Raymond told his doctors that he cared about Martha, but he never actually loved her. And Martha wrote to her mother saying, quote, "Oh yes, he's brave when it comes to talk and hurting others. He can kill without batting an eyelash. But to hurt himself, he'd never do it. It takes a man to kill himself, not a snivelling, low-down, double-crossing, lying rat like him." But while Raymond wasn't busy writing to Martha, incredibly, he spent his entire time on death row, writing to his wife Encarnacion, who was still living in Spain with his children. On January 8th, 1951, Raymond wrote to her saying, quote, "Kisses and hugs to the children, and you receive a million kisses and hugs from the one who will always have you until the last second of my life." Now, Encarnacion knew that he had been involved with a lot of other women. She knew that he had killed people and that he had abandoned her and their family, but she still considered Raymond to be her husband, and she wrote back to him lovingly saying, "Kisses from the children, all my love to you from your wife Encarna." Now, eventually, Martha and Raymond's appeals failed, and their execution date was set for the 8th of March, 1951. As their time on Earth was running out, the pair reconciled with each other and they began declaring their love as the prison staff were preparing for their executions. A total of 52 people came to witness the execution of Martha and Raymond, which was an unusually high number. It included 9 judges, as well as press and police officials from New York and Michigan. On the 8th of March, Martha ate a good breakfast of ham, eggs, and coffee, and then she took a shower. She wanted to spend her last day with a prison official named Matron Evans, but she was very angry when she learned that Matron Evans' shift would be over and that someone else would be on duty. Martha wrote a final angry letter saying, quote, "I do not appreciate it one bit, but I am glad that no member of my family will know how hurt and misled my last day was. It hurts me deeply to realize that I have been wrong in thinking that there could be good in a state-paid employee." Her last meal consisted of fried chicken, French fries, and a lettuce and tomato salad. Meanwhile, Raymond ordered an onion omelet, French fries, chocolate, and a Cuban cigar. He was especially nervous, but he was reassured when he got a note last minute from Martha, professing her undying love to him. He said, quote, "The news brought to me that Martha loves me is the best I've had in years. Now I'm ready to die, so tonight I'll die like a man." But that wasn't to be the case. Raymond was panic-stricken and paralyzed with fear when the procedure began at 11 p.m., and he actually had to be carried and sat into the electric chair where he died. Then, when Martha was led from her cell, Martha gave a final statement to the press and said, quote, "What does it matter who is to blame? My story is a love story, but only those tortured with love can understand what I mean. I was pictured as a fat, unfeeling woman. I am not unfeeling, stupid, or moronic. In the history of the world, how many crimes have been attributed to love?" She was then escorted to be executed by the matrons. She squeezed into the chair with some difficulty before she was strapped down, and then she mouthed the words, "So long," and by 11:24 p.m., 31-year-old Martha Seabrook Beck was dead. And there you have it, guys. That was the whole story of the Lonely Hearts Killers. I'd love to hear what you guys thought of the case. Let me know in the comments. You can message me on Instagram, and I'll see you guys in the next episode. Bye.